600 spot on your dial. WICC, Bridgeport, Connecticut.
I'm Bud Finch, and I'll be back right after Andy Corona's news next over the sound of New Haven, WELI.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Bob Steele of WTIC Hartford, speaking to you from the Army's Bradley Field in central Connecticut, where 25 or 30 big four-engine bombers have arrived in the past hour or so. More are coming in all the time.
The latest news from the WTHT Hartford Times newsroom.
Town Hartford, we bring you Hartford Speaks, transcribed. I'm Bob Maher. Here's Una King.
Oh, you bright little spring boy. You're anticipating it a little bit, aren't you?
That's number 83, everybody, at WTIC, the Dickie Robinson Countdown Show, as we check out the top 100 records for 1967.
The Ken Griffin Show. WPOP.
From high atop Radio Mountain at 95.7, this is WBMI Hartford, Maryland. My name is Dan Bloom.
Connecticut Radio Memories, a series chronicling the first six decades of Connecticut's radio stations, as told by the people behind the microphones and behind the scenes. Episode 2, Static Free, the story of Hartford's first FM station and other Hartford FMs that don't have AM counterparts.
You know, often refer to themselves as the first FM station because we had an engineer who did research that showed that the license went back to being the first FM station.
Gary Lee Horn.
I know that that's in dispute with WDRC.
Right. It's unfortunate that that dispute actually exists.
Larry Titus.
The dispute is because DRC claims that they had the frequency before HCN did, right? And, HCN does, but and that's because they kind of co-resided for a little bit. Doolittle started HCN. The power lines were brought up the west side of the mountain. Department of Navy came out with cannons, and on top of the mountain with a cannon got the string out initially and then used that to haul up the power cables. Armstrong and Doolittle did a fair amount of work up there. Armstrong being the inventor of FM,
right,
and super regen radios, etc. All of his inventions you listen to now, by the way, still, even with satellite radio, you still have the same stuff that he invented back in the 30s. You're still using that technology. It gets into a gray area in the 50s when WDRC said, let's not have a radio station on the FM dial because it's not making any money.
Right.
So they abandoned the frequency. It didn't exist for them. It was taken over by Concert Network. Concert Network picked up the frequency immediately when DRC abandoned it. DRC a year later said, oh, big mistake. We really do want to have an FM. So they went back on the air with another FM frequency, another FM allocation, okay, having nothing to do with the allocations that now Concert Network had. So since DRC didn't have an FM for a year, how can they claim to be the oldest? Well, they can claim to be the oldest, but they can't claim to be the oldest continuously broadcasting FM station, whereas HCN can, by allocation, say that they're the oldest. That's why there's a dispute, because HCN actually had that frequency allocation, which then changed to 105.9, and DRC was on 102.9. So DRC can like claim to it because, yeah, it started off as a Doolittle Radio Corporation. It was Doolittle's radio station,
right,
but they abandoned the frequency,
right,
and didn't have an FM outlet for a year. So they can both claim the same thing under different criteria. And it's interesting because Wayne Mulligan, who is the president and general manager of WDRC, is a close personal friend. And when I started bragging about, well, you know, HCN, blah, 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 he said, no, we've got all this documentation to prove that it's ours. And I was fascinated because I have documentation to prove just the opposite. And they all show the same pictures of Doolittle, you know. So it's convoluted, and it's by definition, you know, who wants to define it which way.
I want to talk a little bit about FM radio and why it was such a breakthrough.
Frank Donovan.
It was not only because it was essentially static free, but the other thing that was important is the frequency range that it was able to transmit. You could go up to 20,000 cycles per second, maybe more, which a high-pitched violin and so forth could do. And all of a sudden, this whole spectrum of music was enriched by that. I remember getting an FM radio set, an excellent one, a Fisher. And I thought, wow, 20,000 cycles per second, hertz, now called hertz. And then I no sooner bought the thing, and I had my ears tested, and I had AM quality ears. I only owned up to 6,000. It was all wasted. A fellow came along and set up what he called a concert network, WHCN, BCN, NCN. And here in Hartford, it was HCN, Hartford Concert Network, Boston Concert Network, Providence, and so forth.
Also, I was on WHCN.
Ivor Hugh.
I broadcast the Hartford Symphony concerts. We will put on the Hartford Symphony concerts when Fritz Mahler was the conductor. You know, today it's a big, big deal, you know, when you go to the opera, for example, or at you see big signs that say, this is being broadcast by PBS, you know, right, we're going to do this and that. We just went on the air and did it. And I was the announcer for Fritz Mahler. He was always late. And I remember having to fill in for at least sometimes a half hour when he would not start the concert in time. And it was engineered by Al Colt, you know, the Colt firearm. One of the sons was a genius in FM broadcasting. He had a huge studio and he did a lot of recordings.
Larry Titus.
Yeah, Concert Network was classical and it was HCN in Hartford originated virtually no programming. It was either totally automated or rebroadcast where they could get off from other stuff.
Tell by the name of T. Mitchell Hastings.
Bryant Thomas.
It was his goal to have all concert music on a variety of stations on a rebroadcast basis.
In its heyday in the 50s, there were 13 stations in what was called the Golden Chain up the East Coast, most of which would rebroadcast each other.
In other words, he would start the program in Boston.
WBCN in Boston, Boston Concert Network.
It would be rebroadcast and picked up by a station in Providence.
At XCN in Providence.
And put on that station. And then the Hartford station would rebroadcast the Providence station.
HCN in Hartford, Hartford Concert Network.
And the New York station would rebroadcast the Hartford station.
And NCN in New York.
And it went all the way down to Philadelphia, to Baltimore, and eventually to Washington. And ideally, it would have gone to Richmond in what they have called the Golden Chain. That was Mitch Hastings' big dream.
The station in Maine, and there are 13 stations up and down the East Coast, all ending in CN. It's a concert network.
This is the Concert Network.
He soon ran into money problems.
Again, Bryant Thomas.
AFTRA sent him these outrageous bills for a classical music station because they weren't playing any AFTRA-rated music, but he played just enough of it, so AFTRA said, well, we're going to sock it to this guy. So he'd have the bookkeeper cut two checks, a big one for what they wanted and a small one for what he wanted to pay. And at the last minute, he'd say, well, I think I'm only going to take the small check. And eventually, he'd sweet-talk AFTRA into taking the smaller check, and that's the way Mitch operated. He was a charming man, but historically out of money. I mean, there were days that the paychecks bounced in Boston and you had to be the first one in the bank to get your money, and it was tough. Those were tough days. Mitch was a piece of work. There are a million Mitch Hastings stories, and you know, each one is funnier than the next. And he had a frontal lobotomy when he was in his 60s and survived.
T. Mitchell Hastings was the guy who owned it.
Paul Payton, air name Country Paul.
Legend said, and it's probably true, he had a steel plate in his head and he should never do anything without consulting with his lawyer first. Of course, he always did, which gave his lawyer an awful lot of work to do and thus, no doubt, a lot of money.
But he was a tough guy, but he's gone.
Again, Larry Titus.
T. Mitch Hastings sold off stations to make money to stay alive and stay afloat.
Again, Bryant Thomas.
And Mitch sold off WNCN in New York.
He had just sold off NCN in New York.
WXCN in Providence.
XCN was off the air, but we still held the license. Mm-hmm. So we had to maintain the tower, but, I mean, there's just no demand for anything on FM.
And held on to Hartford and Boston. The relay system had ceased to operate. They realized that it was not reliable, and picking up a rebroadcast from Boston in Meriden was a lot different from picking up a rebroadcast in Providence. And Providence to Meriden was not a problem. Boston to Meriden was a problem. So the rebroadcast was out the window. There was a call from somebody in Boston at the Concert Network, where WHCN was owned at the time. That was in 65 and 66. And they wanted somebody to go up on West Peak 6 nights a week and run this radio station 36 hours a week in order to hold a license. It had been dark for a number of years because this Concert Network dream had not fulfilled itself. And what they did was they made tapes of various hours of concert music that were done in Boston. And they even put on a dual ID, and it was really funny because no one was sure that it was legal at the time. But at any rate, they used to say, you are tuned to the Concert Network, WBCN Boston and WHCN Hartford, both serving New England with the world's finest concert music. Now, the fact that they weren't live at the time with that ID didn't seem to bother them, but it was on the tape that I would rebroadcast in Hartford. So people were constantly calling, well, where can I get this WBCN? And of course, it was nowhere to be found in Connecticut. Yeah. And neither was HCN in Hartford. That was confusing to listeners, and I don't think that helped in the process, but it was the only way we could really do it in an efficacious manner. Boston always continued to operate, providing proper Bostonians with a steady diet of classical music, and it was always successful because it was Boston. Hartford was another story, and the issue with HCN was that they just wanted to see if they could keep this thing going until they could find some sort of viable way to have it make money. It never happened in that format. Hartford was not ready to support an all-classical music station on FM. It just wasn't there, and there just wasn't enough demand. There wasn't enough eyebrow audience to deal with that. And that's why it eventually switched formats to good music, the beautiful music format.
HCN in Boston had converted to rock in 1968. HCN was a year later in Hartford.
One of the things that always struck me,
again, Frank Donovan,
that really put FM radio on the map was not the jazz and not Donovan on Broadway, but rock and roll, with all the kids went over with. And the other thing that did, it's semantics. They started having these big bashes in football fields and layers, and they called them concerts. It's just one word, but I'm going to the concert, Mom and Dad. Okay, take care. That's nice. So in any event, that's what really was the big breakthrough, I think.
Again, Larry Titus.
Some of the people that were doing WWH radio, which would be Neil Portnoy and Randy Mayer in specific, decided, gee whiz, there's this other FM radio station on the dial called WHCN that is floundering and ready to go away, and wouldn't it be neat to have this neat little rock format on this station 24 hours a day? So they started putting that together, and I got involved with that group, those two, and helped put on WHCN, which went in the air in 1969.
Neil Portnoy.
Let's see, I was living with Larry and Randy Mayer and another person, I think, on Dauntless Lane, I guess it was, in Hartford. We were renting a three-bedroom place, and I think four of us were in there. So Randy had this buddy who worked up in Boston in the same building that WBCN was in, and he knew these guys, and at that time WBCN owned WHCN. WHCN consisted of a transmitter in a building on West Peak in Meriden, and a crown automation system.
Automated. It had a crown automation system with all these big 10-inch reels of tape playing the same thing over and over and over again, which was garbage music.
Right now, you're listening to Hartford's Wonderful World of Music Station at Stereo 106 on Everyone's FM Radio. This is WHCN Hartford.
Basically, they play what we used to call background music at the time.
It was a pit. It was barely on the air.
And it was all automated, and there was this one guy who just took meter readings on the transmitter for HCN and for the other station that was in that same building. The transmitter was in that same building.
Coincidentally, my now brother-in-law did work for HCN back then before we came on board, when it was still Concert Network Classical Music. He had gone in. The station was on the air maybe 3 or 4 hours a day if it was lucky. The antenna was homemade by Hal. It was a dipole antenna about 30 feet up on the tower, because the main antenna had a short at some place.
So Randy had this buddy Peter up in Boston who knew the BCN guys, and he said, hey, you want to go try to talk to them into letting us run this radio station? So I said, sure. So Randy and I drove up to Boston one day and talked to Ray Reapin, I think the guy's name was, who was running WBCN. And, you know, he said, sure, you can turn it into rock if you want, but I don't have any money. So he says, we got all this old equipment.
Anything that BCN was throwing out up in Boston, we clomb onto, including their tapes. We had no budget, zero, nothing, So it was begging for equipment.
And we can give you $60 a week a piece, because that's what we're paying now to have the guy take the meter readings. And so we scraped up a whole bunch of old equipment and built a studio in the attic of this little transmitter building on West Peak in Meriden. One of the features of that, of course, was that it was screened in with copper screening to keep the radio frequency interference from the audio.
I mean, we were operating on top of this transmitter building on top of a mountain in a studio that had been an attic that we had lined with copper screen. We had to build equipment from scratch, and the opportunity that HCN provided was allowed me to, like, the boards we made, you know, from scrap parts, from automation parts. Got the automation system. Hey, here's an amplifier card. We can use this in the output for this thing. We built stuff from scratch that was from garbage. Stuff that BCN didn't want literally was on its way out to the dump You know, we'd go dumpster diving.
And we scrounged equipment and put together a studio. And I think, I went on the air in May of 1969. I think it was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I had the 4 to 10 shift. Randy had the 10 to 3 in the morning shift. And we both recorded our music that we played and ran it on the automation system the next morning.
Our broadcast hours were determined by, first it was Randy and Neil. When HCN was on the air, it was originally just Neil and Randy. We did everything on tape. The original programming was on reel-to-reel, recorded at the UH studios because we didn't have a live studio on top of West Peak back then. We'd drive up with it and stuff it on the automation system and just put these tapes on. We were lucky that there was so much new music out at that point in time that we were able to really be the first to broadcast Moody Blues. Spirit actually came up and visited us. John Mayall, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just huge number of brand new artists that were coming out that are now standards. We were the first station to play these.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man?
There was folk, yep. You know, so there was Dylan and Pete Seeger and Joni Mitchell and Joan Baez and stuff in the folk genre.
Everybody now trying to make it real compared to what? Come on, baby.
There was jazz. We played some jazz. I remember, I think, playing Eddie Harris's Compared to What. That was recorded that year in Montreal, or maybe it was 67. The record just came out. We played whatever we could get our hands on. We always had requests for things like The Iron Butterfly, which wasn't really a favorite of mine. We had Fleetwood Mac and The Stones and Beatles, of course. So that was it. It was just the two of us at the beginning.
Neil soon left the station. I think a month in or 2 months in, he left.
I mean, after a few months of riding down to West Peak on Randy's Honda 305 Dream motorcycle, I got kind of tired of that and the $60 a week and took a job. Oh, I think it was with a record company down in Wallingford, Poison Ring Records. And that's when Larry Titus took my place there.
And that gave me the opportunity to work there full time because I was like part time running around being me. And I did a radio show. Randy did the afternoon show and I did the night show. I went on at 7 and went off whenever I got tired. Okay. And whenever I got tired, I would go downstairs and turn off the transmitter. And it wouldn't come back on the air until like when Randy got in the next day, which might have been 10 or 11 in the morning. Yeah. A lot of UH staff ended up on HCN for obvious reasons because Randy, who was the station manager and general manager and whatever of WHCN at the time, Randy knew where the talent was, and that was at WWUH. Yeah. And so a lot of the people who worked at UH ended up coming over to WHCN. 1969 was the summer of Woodstock, and we had this station on the air. And I manned the station while we sent John Lomenzo. He did the jazz show. We had a ticket for Woodstock, and we sent him to Woodstock to do reports from Woodstock. Mm-hmm. The first one, the real one. The others are all fake. And we had a tight association with Capitol Records and Columbia Records. And any time that they got anything new of any rock nature, they'd bring it to us. Okay. Literally, they'd come to us because we were virtually the only outlet. DRC says, well, we had Scene of the Unheard with Ken Griffin. That was like a 2-hour show once a week, right, on Sunday night. You started off small. I mean, we gave away a lot of advertising. We would advertise them in specific. I remember we had one guy in the Berlin Turnpike that would offer free towing within 100 feet of his place. The underground culture in Hartford back then allowed us to advertise places like the UFO.
Now, you want to keep the UFO in mind for all your Christmas gifts for your friends. You know, the special kind of gifts for special people. Things like pipes and papers. All kinds of other mind distractions. Things like American flag papers. And also the $100 bill papers. Yeah, that's the way to do it, you know. If you're going to take chances, you might as well do it with $100 bills, right?
Right.
Now, the UFO has lots of other out-of-the-way clothes, too. Things like American bandstand sweaters. Shoulder bags. Fitted coveralls. Candles. Books, bells, body shirts, truth and soul sweaters, and velvet tie-dyed coveralls. I know you're sitting there, you're going, where? Well, you'll have to wait till tomorrow. And tomorrow the place to go in Hartford is 16 Union Place, across from the train station.
UFO was a clothing store. Alternative attire. So they had bell-bottom pants, and they had pipes, and they had very drug-oriented culture.
Right.
And, of course, we never did any drugs up there, so I wouldn't know. And actually,
I never did.
There were a lot of boutiques and places like that that would advertise. A lot of times we did advertising just for straight trade.
Again, Bryant Thomas.
If you think back of how FM radio in the car developed, FM is a line-of-sight proposition in terms of a transmitter rather than a thing with signal strength. So if you don't see it, you don't get it. And in a hilly terrain like Connecticut, not so much the Connecticut River Valley, but areas to the west and east, which are very hilly, the FM signals were less than good when it came to being able to be received in stereo. So as this whole thing evolved, it was hard for people to justify having FM in a car because the reception was so pitiful.
Again, Larry Titus.
We had promotions where we would hook up with gas stations and Jody's, which was just starting out back then, to put in these little FM converters that would take FM signal and convert it down to AM radio. And
for, except for car radios?
Yeah,
or, okay.
For car radios. Yeah. For home radios, you're stuck with a separate tuner. There are very few AM FM sets out there. We moved to Hartford, 100 High Street in 1970. We suffered through part of a winter up there and decided we couldn't live up there. Yeah, because the only heat we had in the building was from the transmitter. We had an electric toilet. And the water, you couldn't drink the water. You had to bring your own water. Water was not potable up there. Pretty amazing.
That last cut, A Very Pretty Thing by Greenlight Sunday. Thing called Glen Helen. Before that, Simon and Garfunkel with Leaves That Are Green. Don McLean with Magdalen Lane. James Taylor with Fire and Rain. Dave Mason with Can't Stop Worrying, Can't Stop Loving. Lovecroft with The Dawn, and The Moody Blues with Tuesday Afternoon. This, of course, is Sunday evening. This is Sunshine with you, and I'll be here until somewhere around 12 p.m. Midnight, the magic hour at which Jim Zeiner comes in to entertain you until 6 in the morning, when Ronnie Berger will be coming in to do his thing. You're listening to WHCN in Hartford, the station where happiness comes naturally.
Jim Shanahan, air name Jim Shannon.
The nucleus of the staff at HCN were former University of Hartford students who worked at WWUH, including the late John Labella, I might add.
Charlie Horwitz.
John Labella was a transfer in like I was. He came from Rensselaer Polytech.
Paul Payton.
Larry Titus, who was the chief engineer and who, along with the late Randy Mayer, built the control board. $35 worth of homebrew parts and some of the world's best radio went through that board.
Somewhere in there was Redbone, which Gordon left you with. And I picked up on, and here I am. Good evening, all. This is Larry.
Larry Titus.
And I was making $40 a week to start there at HCN. And that was virtually, you ate, slept, and breathed radio back then. And you did it for the love of it. And you were paid a little bit of gas money. I would eat once a day. McDonald's on the way to the site. I was very thin. I was into blues, and I was into what you would call now acid rock, and some jazz. We did have a specific jazz show on Sunday nights. We did a lot of local concerts, too, like the Moody Blues. We did Chicago. I had the greatest thrill doing Chicago, being the announcer for them and working with them backstage and then going on stage and announcing them. And they had set up and were actually chunking along a little beat. And I went on stage and I said, "Hey, everybody, you know, I'm Larry Titus from HCN." Yeah. Never used a fake name. I always used my real name. And then I said, I forget what I said. And then I said, "And here's Chicago." And when I said Chicago, they broke right into song. And it was just amazing to be standing right in front of them as they broke into song. I still get goosebumps. Absolutely thrilled. Especially such a tight group as they are. So we did a lot of stuff like that, and the listenership just kept on growing and growing and growing.
He was a great guy.
Gordon Weingarth.
He was one of the first people. See, I got there, I started working there in January of 71. It switched format in summer of 1969. My understanding of Larry's career was he was the engineer not only when I was there, but at the time they switched over. And he was also a guy who would also fill in and do shows if you needed to.
One of those rare moments in broadcasting. Oops, broke my neck. When you get occupied doing one thing or another and running around and thinking about your cold and how miserable you are. One of those moments and you end up without a record on the turntable. for the next cut. So I turned on the microphone instead and said something like, "This is WHCN in Hartford, and that's supposed to make everything okay." I don't know, I still feel lousy, and I still don't have a record.
And I was doing full-time radio. I was doing full-time announcing, and then I was doing full-time engineering at the same time, making the station better electronically, but I was still doing a full-time shift for a couple of years. And finally, I saw that I wasn't real good as an announcer compared to a lot of the people who were starting to come in, and I also felt that I really wanted to dedicate more time to doing engineering. And Randy, God bless his heart, also had a first-class license, which was required back then, and he did not have to hire me as an engineer, and he did, because I was his friend, and that gave me my real break in engineering.
Sean Edinburn.
Larry Titus, terrific guy. He can disappear into a room with an aluminum box, a soldering gun, and a wire. He can come out of the room with something sophisticated. I mean, he's that clever.
And I still did announcing part-time for years after that.
Kind of a lengthy thing there. Somewhere in there was the Moody Blues, and let's see, that was Leo Kottke with the Vaseline Machine Gun. And Jimi Hendrix was in there a little bit, Star Spangled Banner, and let's see, Lovecraft was in there, Spin, 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 and I can't think of who all else was around, but doesn't make any difference, does it, now? New things come in every day at the UFO, so go in and look around and see some of the new things that they've got in this week. And while you're up there on Union Place, why don't you check out the Polyphony, sometimes pronounced Polyphony, and they carry almost all of the newly released albums, the UFO Boutique or Polyphony, both on Union Place across from the train station in Hartford. Speaking of Hartford, that's where we are. We're WHCN in Hartford. Said that once. This is Larry. We'll be here for, oh golly, gosh gee whizzaroos, buckaroos. We'll be here till 2.
So HCN allowed me a lot of chance to experiment, explore, do a lot of research. I ultimately ended up being a vice president, director of engineering at Concert Network.
Those days, equipment was much more primitive, and it required a lot of maintenance / fixing. So if you didn't have a good guy who was accessible, you could have some major problems in radio stations. He was the guy.
Again, Jim Shanahan.
Ray White was on staff, a guy named Mike Shallett was the program director. Also Country Paul Payton.
Country Paul Payton, he came from BRU, Brown University.
Probably one of the best musicologists I've ever met in my life. Encyclopedic knowledge of rock and folk. He was there for several years while I was there.
Paul Payton.
Hartford has always been kind of unique because it's just outside the New York media. New Haven's in it, but Hartford's out of it, even though you can get some. And Boston as well. Boston sort of ends at Worcester and Providence. So Hartford and Springfield really had an opportunity to be their own place, but in between two highly sophisticated and well-developed markets. So it kind of gave us a luxury to sound bigger than we were. And one of the things that impressed me when I came to Hartford was just what a huge major market sound WDRC and WPOP had in terms of top 40, and just, you know, how big WTIC sounded and felt and actually was. So it was quite an impressive place to be doing radio. The music director when I got there was a fellow named Ronnie Berger.
I'm Ronnie Berger for the Progressive Radio Network.
Who was in a band called Exit 99 after the original numbering off the Wilbur Cross Parkway for the Yukon exit. And they changed their name to Sunship, got an album deal on Capitol Records. The album unfortunately came out and went back in, and Ronnie eventually got out of the radio business. When I came into the station, I had replaced a fellow named Tom Lane, about whom I knew very little.
Charlie Horwitz.
Tom Lane. This guy was a great jock. Great taste, but he had offended some exec at G-Fox by saying something moderately inappropriate, and so he lost his job at HCN.
He had apparently said something quite negative about one of the saleswomen at G-Fox on the air. I believe he had said it as a parody, but it was not taken as such. A lot of heat was generated. He was a very popular guy among the staff, and when he got fired and I got brought in, I was not very popular for a while, and I sort of had to earn my stripes. Now, I guess I managed to do that, because eventually when Ronnie left the station, I succeeded him as music director.
A city boy, Dave Bowie, Suffragette City, followed Rod Stewart, and every picture tells a story. Latest from the Sutherland Brothers in Quiver, In the Arms of Mary. Come Softly to Me, the Fleetwoods, tonight on WHCN. Good Friday evening, friends. I'm Charlie Hot Parts at The Source with the Concert Collective, just a lot of good tunes away.
Charlie Horwitz,
Charlie Hot Parts.
Charlie Hot Parts was there. Charlie Horowitz was also one of the founding people at UH.
Charlie Horowitz, air name Charlie Hot Parts.
I went on to work at WHCN. Well, I started while I was in college, and so that was maybe 71, 72.
It's 8 o'clock. We're WHCN, Hartford.
One of my first shows, I substituted for Ronnie, and the station at the time was in the basement of the building across the street from the Greyhound station. So it's a beautiful Saturday morning, I'm spinning records, and the Greyhound bus pulls into the terminal. And all of a sudden, I mean, I hear this loud rumbling, and I don't know what the hell's going on. The needle on the record starts bouncing and skipping. And for the rest of my show, I had to contend with that every time a bus came or left the terminal. That was High Street, before we moved to 60 Washington Street.
Broadcasting as a community service of the University of Hartford, this is WWUH West Hartford, WAPJ Torrington, WDJW Summers, and WWEB Wallingford. And now back to Connecticut Radio Memories.
Stu Kaufman.
Do work there.
And doing in the court of the Crimson King. That's right, Stu. Screw your teeth in. Pizza makes your mouth a little slick. Here at WHCN, we have a news blimp coming up this hour. We're still looking at requests, and then Act 1 this morning, starting at 1 o'clock. Procol Harum.
The news department was Jim Cameron.
Gary Lee Horn.
I've been told that there was a newscaster named Jim Cameron who used to do a newscast every day, like called the 544 or something, like as if it was a train pulling out.
If you sit by your radio Monday through Friday at 544, Jim and Gabby take you all the way there to the news that meets your ear and then some. It's the 544 at 106 FM.
And I know he's in Fairfield County. Speaking of trains, he's the head of some kind of a community organization that oversees Metro North.
And Linda Goldfarb, later Gabby, now she's Gabby Parsons.
Gabby worked there.
Gabby Parsons.
I went to Syracuse University, and I got my master's in radio and television, and worked in Worcester, Massachusetts right after I graduated for about a year, and then came back to Hartford in, I think it was late 73, and worked at WHCN till early 77. I had so much fun there, I can't even begin to tell you. We had artists come to the station all the time, and we got to go to fabulous concerts, and what was wonderful for the music freaks like me is you got a copy of every single new album because you were your own programmer. So I kind of miss that. That was awesome. And when I first started there, I was doing news, and we did very creative, produced news with comedy drops and with music. I am one of the few women who was, I will say, fortunate enough to do a program on WHCN called Prisoner's Request. It was on Sunday evenings, and what we did was there were a lot of prisons that were in our listening area, and so the prisoners and their girlfriends and family would send in dedications and songs, and we would play the songs and read them on the air. I remember it would be things like Let's Get It On, and then it was followed by the Dr. Demento Show. That was my Sunday music shift at WHCN, and we were very free-form radio station, and you could play anything you wanted of any genre of music.
Jim Shanahan worked there.
Again, Jim Shanahan.
I auditioned for a fill-in position in 72 at HCN-FM, which was a progressive freeform station, one of the few in the country, and was able to get a job as a part-time / fill-in announcer. So I was doing both, WWUH and HCN, while I was still in college. And then upon commencement, I was offered actually a full-time job at HCN, which I took. Rather than go to grad school, I took the job at HCN and worked there until 1978.
Jim Shannon and some other folks on the station were very much into the British rock thing. Larry Titus was another one. You know, from guys like them, I learned about Gentle Giant and Genesis and some of the other people who don't always make the classic rock cut now, which is a very, very narrow spectrum of what part of the spectrum of what we were playing at the time. Gordon Weingarth, he was on the air just before I was when I first signed on, was at HCN for a while.
I started in January of 71 full-time, and I did nights. Most of the time I was working there, I did nights.
So I was in a world, it's not that I would come to the programming meetings and stuff and I would see the office staff part of the time, but the vast majority, maybe 75% of the time there, I was working either overnights or nights.
And ultimately, he wound up at WPLR, became famous as their program director during one of their earlier really major progressive incarnations, and wound up back at HCN in its glory days of rock as its, I think, general manager. And as I said, is now either sales manager or general manager over at WCCC. So we had some pretty illustrious people there.
People who worked at HCN and had originally come from other places found the relationship back to UH unbelievable. There was just a lot of people that just seemed to be on the air at HCN one day and UH the next. I don't ever know what the audience said in reaction to that.
The wave of WBRU people who came to Hartford, and we were going to, quote, take over WHCN and kind of remake it in WBRU's image. Of course, we ran smack into the founding fathers of WHCN, who were mostly former WWUH people, which is my first experience with the interrelationship between the two stations, and also headlong into a whole bunch of guys from Yale who had decided to come up from WYBC and remake HCN in their image. So needless to say, there was not an inconsiderable amount of internal politics going on.
We had HCN had an influx of people from BCN at one time. Sam Copper came down. He was program director, so he changed the sound a little bit. So there was always a influx of out-of-towners as well as Hartford people.
There were some people who were big at WBCN up in Boston who came down, particularly Debbie Ullman and Sam Copper. Sam became program director for a while. For a while, it seemed everybody was PD for 6 weeks. I was, Larry Titus was, Wynn White was, Sam was. Again, they'd create crises from Boston and stuff would go down. But, you know, they were also talented, but very different. They really had a Boston sensitivity.
Bob Weir, and from the Ace album, playing in the band. I am your captain from Closer to the Ground, Grand Funk. The Captain and Me, and Uriah, and that from the Doobie Brothers in the title track from their new LP. A little past 1 o'clock, good morning, this is WHCN-FM, Stereo 106, and we're in Hartford, Connecticut. And this is Zarkov. I'll call Earth until Babushi comes in and he'll blast off at 2 o'clock.
Jim Ziner was there. He was as Hartford as you could get.
One of the major guys was a guy named Jim Ziner, and Jim's deceased. He passed away a few years ago.
A fellow named Jim Ziner, and to a lesser extent, Wynn White, both of whom have unfortunately graduated to the great radio studio in the sky, were much more sort of R&B and what we used to call nightclub music oriented. Jim in particular turned us on to groups like Tower of Power, which has had and probably still has in the entire recorded history one of the tightest horn sections on a parallel with James Brown's section. I mean, these guys were phenomenal. You could kind of tell when they were on.
Again, Charlie Horwitz.
Back in the day, there was an expression, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, which basically meant anything went. And that's the way it was.
Those are the Birds from their new album, Untitled, and a song called Chestnut Mare. Not that kind of mare. Love and Spoonful, an old, remember that? Nashville Cats? You don't want to remember that. All right. Neil Young sang till the morning comes. New group called Trilogy have an album out now. And the song you heard from the album, which is called Trilogy, is called Red Wine. Also Thought Number One. A couple of things. And again, from the new Brewer and Shipley album, Tokyo Road, the light, the blinding light. Yep, it's not new anymore, I guess, but it's the latest. From Idle Wild South, these are the Allman Brothers.
When I was at UH and at HCN, there were albums and groups and particular songs on albums that we all liked, that the music director wanted us to place an emphasis on, but nothing was forbidden. We always used to joke about this jock or that jock would play whatever fell off the wall. Well, literally, it could happen, you know?
Again, Larry Titus.
We played new groups. We were very attuned to repetition. We had no playlists per se. Behind us, we had probably 1,200 albums, and any announcers was free to choose any song he wanted to at any day part he wanted to. With some guidance, while we had nobody really mandating, okay, you have to play every day at 2 o'clock, you have to play this song by Eric Clapton. There was no rotation. We had no programming consultants.
Again, Paul Payton.
WHCN at that point was free form. We had a new bin. We had a hot bin. That's about what we had. Later on, when George Taylor Morris became program director, and he was one of my saints in radio, there are three all in Hartford, the late Charlie Parker from WDRC and Johnny Michaels, who had been over at WWYZ and took it country. Three guys who, you know, I still sit in awe of their talents, their abilities to manage, and their radio vision, and even more than their vision, their abilities to carry it off. But when George came in, we had something called the tub, which was stuff that there was interest in because somebody was coming into town, somebody was about to have a new album out. It was kind of our, you know, this is the bin of artists to play now because, you know, things are about to happen with them. But other than that, no, there was no playlist. There were at various times were suggestions that you play a certain number from each just to try to keep a program balance, a certain amount of familiar versus non-familiar, again, just to keep a balance.
Blasting, billowing, bursting forth with the power of 10 billion butterfly sneezes. Man, with his flaming pyre, has conquered the wayward breezes. Climbing to tranquility, far above the cloud, conceiving the heavens, clear of misty shroud.
Most of what we did was creative radio. We would play easily an hour's continuous music. Whatever we wanted to play, it was like, you're in my living room. Let's listen to something. This is a great cut. Whoa, man. Moody Blues to our children's children just came out. I got it. Listen to it. Holy cow, can you believe what they're doing? Stuff like that.
But again, the impulsion was basically, be creative, be interesting. You know, you are your audience. You know your audience. Therefore, play what your audience wants. And then maybe step about one footprint more to the conservative side, as in, yes, we may be burnt out on fill in the blank of whatever the hit was at the moment. The audience hasn't heard it as many times as we have, so, you know, it's okay to give it to them again. But if you're really getting tired of it, you know, put it in as creative a surrounding as you possibly can. The segue was an all-important feature. You know, the idea that you were creating longer form compositions of shorter form elements made it a very interesting radio station.
You could basically play anything out of about 1,000 albums. You couldn't play anything that was a top 40 hit, and you couldn't play something that was a sappy ballad, but you could play anything. So there was a lot of emphasis on creativity. And the way that was kind of defined was what you said between records, what you said over records, you know, how you put things together. There's almost nothing like it now except maybe some college radio stations.
Also interesting were the variety of tastes among people in the station. For example, I was a little bit more on the direction of, well, mainstream progressive, but my ear had also come in from pop and from oldies and from country, partly accounting for my name, Country Paul. So I would kind of swing a little bit that way, but, you know, I like R&B and stuff too. But it was a well-balanced station musically, and when we were hitting, we were really hitting. I mean, some of the talent that went through that place was just phenomenal. The Concert Network still owned the station. We would be operating kind of from crisis to crisis. We would resolve it locally, and then they'd create another one from headquarters up in Boston. The station was not exactly thriving financially. We were marginal. I mean, we felt like we were really doing well. Everybody was making $145 a week because we were kind of communal at the time. There were no stars. And, you know, as long as you could eat and live, get paid in records, and your face was at the door of the clubs, particularly Shabu out in Willimantic, which was sort of our house club, if you will, life was fine. You know, we were doing okay. As I said, under Concert Network, we were out-of-town ownership and management, essentially, even though we were supposed to be self-managing, and they would create these crises, and finally they created a crisis.
Again, Larry Titus.
Because we had a program director come through who said, we're going to be urban, black, we're going to go after KND, WKND, a little AM station, we're going to go after that market, and like, whoa, where'd this guy come from? Exactly. Program consultant.
I don't know where they found this guy. His thing was to turn the station into a sort of a top 40 with album cuts machine with a lot of R&B and a lot of pop music, and there was basically open insurrection. I lasted about 6 weeks under him, then went out to Denver, Colorado.
Again, Charlie Horowitz.
Because I remember we had gotten wind that HCN was going to have a format change, and we were just livid that this would happen. And literally every jock was on the air saying, boycott the new HCN when it comes on. Of course, in hindsight, it seems unprofessional, though no one that I remember lost their jobs directly because of it. In fact, we all outlasted that regime, thankfully.
And the station got sold in 74 to Beck Ross, which was a Long Island company which owned WBLI, which was a top 40 station. I think they still are, actually. And Beck Ross brought up a fellow named Jay Mitchell, who promised to be a hands-off general manager, and he brought in George Taylor Morris, the first in my triumvirate of holy program directors, if you will. And George was just the mellowest guy, and he was one of these people who was just totally capable of getting out of the staff what he wanted and making you think it was your idea. Brilliant. Brilliant guy, and just so laid back and so together. He brought me back from exile in Denver, much to my very, very great relief. And I became an off-the-air program director, and then the number one fill-in. So if somebody was out for the day or something like that, I would come in and do their shift. And then I had a new music show on Thursday nights called The Kitchen Sink, which he cutely spelled S-Y-N-C, where we'd basically just take 90 minutes and play stuff from all the new music that came in, talk about it, occasional interviews, but mostly it was just, you know, me and the records, and here's what we got. The station that he set up was wonderful, and George assembled an absolutely brilliant staff. You know, I was there, Jack Richard, who he had brought in from Cleveland. Clem Infante was part of the sort of extended station. Kathy Bryan, who actually worked at CCC but was part of the station family. Marcia Simon was there. Rick Allison had been there. That Ray White, I can't forget Ray White. Ray was a UH guy and one of the best voices on the air. Just this whole amazing, wonderful group of people. The program director, Rich Barna, and the sales manager, Vito Perillo, had both come over from WBRU. Barna is an interesting personality in this thing. He was not program director for a very long time, but he brought to WHCN and made HCN its flagship station the news blimp. The Progressive Radio Network was the rubric under which he operated, and the news blimp was a produced-up news story, if you can sort of envision what Robert Krulwich does now with the science stuff in PBS, very densely produced.
Remember when the typical corporate executive was a white, WASP-type male? And then came equal opportunity employment.
Right on, right on, right on, right on. Look here.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore.
Except what Barna did was he would take sort of a magazine-type news story, because this wasn't really good for breaking news, and write a script which would then be populated by its producer with lines from current songs or other appropriate lines or sound effects.
And the government means business with those laws.
You better take care of business, Mr. Businessman. What's your plan?
Densely produced on tape, and then syndicated to, I think at one point he might have had 100 radio stations around the country on this. Producers all over, but the flagship was really WHCN back in the days when we were at 60 Washington Street in Hartford.
Produced by Country Paul for the Progressive Radio Network.
Again, Larry Titus.
When the programming consultants came in, that's when radio really changed for HCN, because you had somebody that lived in California dictating what people in Hartford were going to listen to. And that was based on what this programming consultant would come in and say, oh, well, you know, I was in the market for 3 weeks and I talked to these people and this is what they want to hear. Well, it turns out that's not what we were playing. You know?
Yeah.
And when they started to get into this rotation thing, that's when I felt that HCN went downhill.
Charlie Horowitz.
And I then left in 76 or 77. That was right before the programming pendulum shifted to people who decided they knew more about music because they'd studied demographics and trends rather than the disc jockeys who actually listened to the music. Those consultants came in and basically changed the face of rock and roll. So I wasn't involved in that era.
Again, Gabby Parsons.
And during my tenure there is when radio started tightening up and formats starting to come in, and we went from play anything you want to here are 700 songs, play them. And that pretty much sent most of my staff scurrying out of radio.
Donna Kelly Gray was there, yes, yes. The ex-wife of Gary Burton, the jazz vibist.
Abby Gray, air name Firefly.
I remember hearing somebody on WHCN doing an entire afternoon of songs with cowbells in them. And so, and he'd have people call in with ideas and requests. So when I actually started doing commercial radio, I did that too. When I could, you know, I'd say, well, how about doing all color songs today and that kind of thing and get people to call in.
I'm Firefly, inviting you to learn about the astrological cycles on As Above, So Below, every Monday through Friday, mornings and evenings at 7:50, here on WHCN.
In Connecticut, I was living on Coventry Lake and went to a show with an incredible string band when they were still together. It was their last few years they were together. And they came over to visit me. I took them out in a rowboat and they stripped all their clothes off and jumped in the lake. That was pretty interesting for me, but I didn't do that, but I watched them do it. Then they saw their first firefly that day. So the name, they kind of dubbed me that. So Robin Williamson gave me that name. But when I started at HCN, they had just started doing the formats. They had hired a consultant from out west, and he had the superstar format, and so we had to follow a certain rotation of albums and stuff. This consultant liked my voice, so he bumped me right up to full-time on afternoon drive, but I had to follow the format.
Again, Gordon Weingarth.
For a lot of the 70s, you had, HCN was the progressive rock station in Hartford, PLR was the progressive rock station in New Haven, and CCC was kind of evolving from top 40 into like a kind of rock station. By the beginning of the 80s, CCC was more like a full-line, quote-unquote, progressive rock station. So the whole rivalry between HCN and CCC had really developed by about early 80s. They hired Lichaway from CCC. Picozzi and the Horn were this great morning show.
Michael Picozzi.
Like 77, 78, 79. But he hired me to do part-time, and eventually I got to do mornings. I was Michael in the Morning back in those days, because you could not have an ethnic name. You had to be like Michael St. John or Bob Roberts. Even on the progressive stations, as that format was called. And I worked there for a couple years, and I had the Radio Dreams, the program director of WMMR in Philadelphia, Jeff Pollock. He offered me a job in Philadelphia. I worked at WMMR. In 85, I was out of work. Yeah. I ran out of stations in Philadelphia to work at. A friend of mine was the program director of WHCN, and he said, hey, as long as you're not working and you're getting married, since you're going to be in town, why don't you fill in on the morning show, because my morning guy just left. So, okay. I filled in, and at my wedding, he was following me around going, we have to talk. Gave me the job, and somebody that I'd worked with in Philadelphia, Gary Lee Horn, was still in Philadelphia, and the show wasn't clicking the way he wanted it, and he said, what do you need? And I said, I need the horn. Then we just had fun on the radio, which is the key.
Cozy and the Horn in the Morning. Classic rock and only the best new rock all day. 105.9 WHCN, Hartford's rock station.
The philosophy that I had was, if someone's going to spare 20 minutes in the morning to listen to us, they're going to get a little bit of everything. They're going to get some information. They're going to get a song. They're going to get a joke. Maybe they're going to win some tickets. And that's the way we tried to do it. And so a little bit of everything.
Gary Lee Horn.
I guess you'd call it, you know, like a radio variety show. There was everything, you know, news, music, talk, you know, interviews with famous people, taking phone calls from listeners, and, of course, contests. So we had a little bit of everything. Well, when I first got there, I was hired to be the morning newscaster and got that job in 1981. And eventually was promoted to news director. That was my first tour of duty. I was there for a couple of years. I worked with Eddie Haskell and Paul Harris. Then I left to go work at WISP in Philadelphia. And when I came back to WHCN for my second tour of duty, I was a co-host of the morning show. So that was a larger position. I still did news, but contributed a lot more to the show.
Hi, this is Bill Clinton. You're listening to Cozy and the Horn on 106HC.
802, it's Cozy and the Horn, 106 WHCN gives you 60 seconds.
What would you like to see the state spend more money?
We're talking with Nick Jones and Lou Gramm of Foreigner.
Back together again. You guys are going on tour in the United States, of course, right?
Yeah, it won't be till later this year. We're starting in the rest of the world in March, beginning in England, and we'll be here probably in August or September.
I was impressed that Lou has gone back to his hometown of Rochester, shunning the glamour of New York and Los Angeles. Angeles to live in Rochester because you want to be near the Kodak plant, right?
I'm actually right in the Kodak plant.
You're putting the little film in the little boxes. Is that what you do now?
Oh, man.
When he's bored. Excuse me, we've not come here to be fooled, eh?
Yeah, it lasted 11 years, which is a good run in radio. In dog years, that would be 77 years. And it was very popular, had very good ratings, and a really dedicated following, and we had great promotions like Live Lunch Luau's and Hawaiian Shirt Friday and Donut Wednesday.
I'm wearing a Hawaiian shirt now because, here's the honest truth, I don't own any real shirts.
Yeah.
I just, through attrition, I've gotten rid of all my other clothes, just Hawaiian shirts.
Yeah. We gave the listeners a lot of things to hang their hat on, you know, different contests and events and promotions. And it was a real sense of family, and people knew us, and we knew a lot of the listeners that, you know, it was great.
Again, Gordon Weingarth.
You know, they just had some really tremendously good people. Bob Bittens did, he was the program director, and he did Middays. HCN switched format, I believe, in 96 or 97. They went to classic rock. They became The River, like, in 2003, 2004.
We did radio back in the 60s and 70s because we loved it.
We all had a hell of a good time playing the rock and roll, enjoying the groups that came into the Hartford area, and entertaining our audience.
We were the first rock station in Connecticut. Yeah. Period. And we covered Connecticut like a glove and up into Massachusetts. I mean, AQY and would say, well, we were the first in the region. They weren't. They were years after us. PLR took a lot of staff from HCN and started their little efforts years after we had really broken the market.
I don't think you'll see the likes of that ever. I can't say ever again, but it was a singular experience for sure. It was rewarding to work with some of the talent that we had at WHCN at the time. Just a really good staff.
Well, I'd like to think that I was one of the guys that was playing rock music in Hartford when nobody else was, and did that for a long time. And I did it from 7 o'clock on, 6 days a week, because John Lomenzo did Sunday and jazz. The Hartford Advocate did an interview of me, you know, 10, 12 years ago, and called me a grandfather of rock in Hartford. And I liked that. Wow. Even though I am going to be a grandfather now, I don't want to. Wow. But I thought that was kind of neat, because I was doing stuff that nobody else was doing on the radio.
After the old WDRC-FM outlet, WFMQ, vacated the 93.7 spot on the dial and became WHCN on 105.9, that left the 93.7 spot unoccupied until 1959, when WFNQ took that spot. In September 1962, it was taken over by South Church Broadcasting in Hartford, which operated on that frequency until 1964 with WSCH.
Yes, hello there, boys and girls, and welcome to The Friendly Forest, a half-hour presentation of some of your favorite songs and stories brought to you by this FM station and your local Council of Churches. And this program is for the boys and girls of the area. Some songs and stories for them that we hope you will enjoy.
Well, I don't know many radio programs.
That's right. We know there are not very many radio programs for boys and girls, so your Council of Churches wants to bring this program to you.
Bryant Thomas.
It was the old WSCH, which stood for South Church Broadcasting in Hartford.
And I'll see you again next time, boys and girls, when we get together near the Friendly Forest. Songs and stories brought to you by this station and your local Council of Churches. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Chooly-doo.
So long, kids.
South Church had run the thing for years, and it was just an unbearably unprofitable thing, and coupled with the non-reliability of having the transmitter 20 miles away from the studio in Hartford, which was a problem in those days, it's not like it is today, they went dark.
In April 1965, it became WLAE.
And here sits this Class B powered FM station in Hartford. An engineer from New Jersey bought and decided to run on a shoestring budget. This fellow, Paul DiSavino, picked the license up for a song, something like $15,000. And he put it on the air in WLAE and put a format similar to that of WPAT in New York, which is all good music, on in Hartford. And he ran it 20 hours a day, which many stations were not at that point. And even though it was mono, the music mix was filling a void. And it succeeded quite well. He had 4 and 5 shares in the book and never made a lot of money with it, but it was a respectable way to nurture the FM band, and had he been able to hang on a little longer, it probably would have been more profitable. But you know, FM was slow to take off in Connecticut, and it took its toll on his pocketbook, so he eventually gave up.
Then in the early 1970s, it became WLVH with an all-Spanish format.
It was the Latin voice of Hartford for a while.
Faltan 18 minutos para las 4 de la tarde. La salsa continúa por la grande de Connecticut ahora. Sabor.
That's the 93.7 that is now WZMX.
University of Hartford students built WWUH-FM and secured a license from the FCC in July 1968.
This is radio station WWUH commencing broadcast activities. WWUH operates in stereo with an effective radiated power of 1,800 watts at a frequency of 91.3 megahertz on the FM dial, as authorized by the Federal Communications Commission in Washington, D.C. Studios, offices, and transmission facilities are located in the Jengris Campus Center of the University of Hartford, 200 Bloomfield Avenue, West Hartford, Connecticut. WWUH is a non-commercial educational radio station licensed to the Board of Regents of the University of Hartford and operated by its students.
The station adopted a slogan of public alternative radio with emphasis on alternative rock, folk music, jazz, classical music, and public affairs programming. WWUH was one of the first stations in Connecticut to carry alternative rock.
In WWUH 91.3 FO, stereoism. The Doors right now, after I coined that brand new word into our English language, their first record ever recorded.
You know, the day destroys a night, night divides a day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, break on through to the other side, yeah.
I think the concept was that the station would be an alternative to most other programming, you know, most of the commercial programming that was on the air.
Neil Portnoy.
So, for instance, you know, we had what we called progressive rock at that time because none of the commercial stations had that.
We had the first progressive rock show in Hartford, you know, a year before WHCN came on with this new style of music called progressive rock in 1969. We had come on with the Gothic Limpworks, and the people that helped found WWH, that started the progressive rock show Gothic Limpworks, jumped ship appropriately and went over and changed WHCN from classical music, Hartford Concert Network, to the rock station that it, progressive rock station there was for 30 more years.
For a time, New York City disc jockey Mort Figa called WWH home.
Welcome, and to urge you to get relaxed, as this lovely Saturday midday permits you to do. This is our man, Buddy Rich, in the background. Bouncing with Bud is the composition, and I'd remind you that you'll be bouncing with MF Twix now and 4 o'clock this afternoon with the focus on jazz, and we say thank you to Marty's Music, Martin Bloomfield, for underwriting these forthcoming 4 hours. Thank you, too, for all your nice telephone calls and birthday cards, about which I'll say more in a few moments. But for now, Bouncing with Bud with BR, Buddy Rich.
UH professor George Michael Ivica had one of the longest-running public affairs shows on the station.
Assassination Journal. This is George Michael Ivica, editor and writer of Assassination Journal, a weekly public affairs presentation on the death of John F. Kennedy and its links to the plots against Fidel Castro, its links to the career and fall of Richard Nixon, to Watergate, to the career and disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa, to certain events in Southeast Asia, in Central and South America, to the Iran-Contra affair, to the clandestine career of George Bush. The story of the still unsolved murder of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, November 22, 1963. This edition of Assassination Journal, Who Killed John F. Kennedy? The Motives in the Assassination of JFK.
Trinity College in Hartford got its own radio station, WRTC, on 89.3 FM in 1958.
And I went to WRTC, RTC Radio Trinity College.
Frank Donovan.
RTC was a college radio station for Trinity College. Back in those days, they had a pretty good thing. I used to do a program called Music in the Night. It was just bum-ba-da-bum-ba-da-bum-ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then I say, and the night shall be filled with music and the cares that infest the day shall fold their tents like the Arabs and as silently steal away. Da, 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 da.
Ray Dunaway recalls WRTC during the late 1960s.
There were some of us who wanted to turn it into to sound like a commercial radio station, you know, frustrated radio people. And then there were the guys who were more of the artist type, and they wanted to do album rock or they wanted to do underground. But I mean, there were weird things. We did Trinity football, and we had that. Late at night, we'd have guys to do, like, I guess what you'd call, for one of anything better, album rock. And then, but the weird thing was, like, like at 6 o'clock at night or 5 o'clock, we'd do the dining hour. And it was like Mantovani. I mean, half of you don't know what I'm talking about here. But it was like, you know, a lot of strings and Percy Faith. I think the faculty, you know, I guess they thought, well, this will be a sop to the community. So we can have fine dining and eat our cheese and drink our wine. And, you know, it'll be something kind of gracious living. So, you know, we did that. And, yeah, it was all volunteer.
This is WRTC-FM in Hartford, Connecticut. Spits and Peebles.
I have a trivia question.
Okay, go right ahead.
You know, remember the Leave It to Beaver?
Oh, do we very remember? Very Leave It to Beaver. Yes, we do.
Okay, who played the father?
I don't know. The father was played by the great Hugh Beaumont.
Absolutely right.
I thought so.
There was a station manager, and there were a lot of guys who worked there that ended up going on into radio. I mean, I can think of a number. Jay Millard, I think he went on to CPTV and ended up doing a whole lot of television. Peter Moore, I think, went to work for CBS. Drew Brinkerhoff, I think he went. So there are a lot of guys. I mean, there are a lot of guys who kind of, you know, radio's weird that way in that you, if you can make a living, you make a pretty good living, but eventually you just get tired of it, you know, if you don't, and you quit. So there were a lot of guys who gave it a shot. You know, it was fun. It was a good crew. And, you know, it was kind of like having your own little private radio station. A lot of fun.
In the 1970s, alternative rock, also called alien rock, occupied a major part of WRTC's evening schedule. Reynolds Onderdunk.
I was involved with some friends who were also doing programs at the station, like Andy Taylor. I've known him for many years. And there was also a gentleman named Andy Mitchell who was doing a show called the Don Quixote Travelogue. He was doing a lot of European rock stuff. And Andy and I were friends and were also interested in that kind of music. I guess back then we called it import music. Go to record stores and go through all the import bins. And you're kind of like exploring different music, not just the music that, you know, that you would find in normal record stores at the time. Andy had a show in 73, I think, and I started in 74, and I guess you could say maybe Michael started in 75, I think, something like that. And so after that, we kind of like formed a core of an evening program that was called Alien Rock. It was like the name of the slot, like the Gothic Blimp Works, like you have.
This is Alien Rock, and this is WRTC Hartford. The Psychedelic Warlord and Michelle from Hell here with you till 10. Till 10 p.m.
Now, I was always a science fiction fan, and I kind of, you know, I fancied myself and others like us to be like bizarre mutants and like outsiders, but aliens, you know, we're aliens playing this music for you, and maybe if you like this music, then maybe you're an alien, that kind of thing. Know that there's something different about you, and that you appreciate this kind of different kind of approach, and this kind of different kind of music. Well, I guess the most salient bands were Gong and Magma, I guess, who seem to be the big names that stay with me, and also Hawkwind and Tangerine Dream. I'd say those were like the big ones.
Though broadcasting from UConn in stores, WHUS still had many listeners in Greater Hartford.
Good morning. This is radio station WHUS beginning another broadcast day. WHUS is owned and operated by the students of the University of Connecticut. WHUS FM operates on an assigned frequency of 90.5 megacycles with a power output of 10 watts as authorized by the Federal Communications Commission. WHUS AM maintains satellite transmitters on the UConn campus at 670 kilocycles.
I mentioned UConn.
Fred Swanson.
I was at UConn from 51 through 53, and for a couple of semesters, I worked on WHUS. It was an AM station then, light classical music, some popular stuff, newscasts. And, well, of course, the big time of the year was in the spring when it was more or less of a radiothon raising funds for the community chest, which is now known as United Way. They would have all sorts of activities going on campus in the spring of those years. But, no, it was a lot of fun. Some of the people who worked on WHUS, of course, went into commercial broadcasting. Fred Locke was the engineer, and for years he ran a radio radio and TV shop. Actually, I think there were a number of them throughout the state. Al Herskowitz, who was the general manager, went into broadcasting, was working at a Rhode Island station, and would later work, I believe, at WNHC-TV, Channel 8 at that time.
The place I kind of got started was WHUS and Storrs, Yukon radio station.
Mike Drexler.
Yeah, actually AM carrier current when I got there, which meant that you had to plug your radio into the wall to hear them. And we were just changing over, and we moved from the dormitory, whatever the building was, Coons Hall, I think, over to what was then the brand new, just opened student center.
Jerry Bishop.
And then somebody came up to me and said, look, we're putting a radio station up in the student center, and you used to MC a bunch of things at Weaver High. I wonder if you wouldn't mind, you know, hosting a show or two. So the Husky Network was, WHUS was created, and I started doing a show there. Well, it was an unusual situation because at that time the radio station was actually illegal. They sent the signal through the air, not through a closed circuit. And if I recall, they actually were selling times to store owners and businesses. And as a matter of fact, I think the FCC was trying to shut them down after a while. As far as the content is concerned, of course, it changed with the times. It was much more conservative in nature than it is now.
And good living means good listening over WHUS FM at 90.5 on your dial.
Know the real joy of good living.
WHUS FM, 90.5 megacycles on your FM dial.
Wayne Norman.
Had to do with the University of Connecticut student radio station, WHUS. I was a matriculating freshman at UConn. I went up to see the campus the prior spring, and I was aware there was a radio station there. And then freshman weekend, when I was, you know, about to be a student at UConn, I went to the student union and happened to stick my head in the radio station, and that's where it all began. I got on the air within a month, did a rather accelerated training process, had my own show, and did a variety of things there, including a Broadway show and some other kind of offbeat shows. But it was really the top 40, the commercial-type radio approach that I liked the most, and I did it the entire time that I was at UConn.
In 1976, the Archdiocese of Hartford launched radio station WJMJ with studios in the basement of the Hartford Seminary. John Ellinger.
Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. JMJ started in 1976. Archbishop Whalen founded this station, John Francis Whalen, and he worked very hard to put it together, and we finally got it started. I am here 28 years.
So you were here right at the beginning?
A year and a half after the beginning I arrived. They had a Miss Costa here who opened the station, and she was invaluable because she got us the piece of property in Burlington, Connecticut, where we have our transmitter, and it's quite a wonderful feat because it's so high. It's on top of Johnny Cake Mountain, and we have a 100-foot tower up there, and it's just great. The radio station is owned by the Archdiocese, and the Archbishop actually is the head of the radio station. I am the general manager, but he truly is in charge. And this station is especially important to me because it's ecumenical. And you know, that's a marvelous thing. The ecumenical factor is that it's a total Christian station, and we have all sorts of programs. We have Roman Catholic, of course, because we are founded by the Archdiocese, but we also have Episcopalian, Lutheran, etc., etc., etc. And these are all represented here. I almost thought the station should be interfaith, and it just didn't work out that way, but we are ecumenical, and that's a marvelous loaf of the bread.
Ivor Hugh.
John Ellinger and I have known each other for many years. When this station went on the air, they wanted to make it ecumenical, and they decided, well, Ivor knows the churches. He's been working for the Council of Churches. After CCC, I worked
right
at the churches. And so they hired me, and I've been on since with Good Evening, Good Music, which I developed at CCC.
You are listening to a complete performance of the opera I Lombardi by Verdi. A work heard for the first time on the 11th of February in Milan in the year 1843. a presentation sung in Italian, Giselda sung by Cristina Deutigon, Orante, Placido Domingo, Pagano, Ruggero Raimondi, Arvino, Jerome La Monaco, Viclinda sung by Desdemona Malvisi, the Ambrosian Singers, and the Royal Philharmonic conducted by Lamberto Gardelli. This music coming to you from WJMJ Hartford, and we'll complete our performance of this opera with Acts 3 and 4. I Lombardi, the opera by Verdi.
And it's been on the air ever since. 7 days a week, because I do a lot of stuff with voice cuts.
And you record it during the day?
Yeah. I don't do too much.
Because I know you do the morning show with Phil Kelly.
Yeah,
too.
Right. And after that, I'm probably doing Good Evening Good Music.
Yeah.
Producing one of the 12 or 15 religious shows that comes on.
Right.
JMJ. It's the only station you can turn to during the Sunday and hear how people worship from all the major denominations.
Right.
From the Catholic Mass to the liturgy of the Russian Orthodox, which is gorgeous.
Yeah.
To the marches of the Salvation Army.
So.
And to the hymns of the Standard Old denomination. So I like doing that work.
Fred Swanson.
Bob Bray. Bob Bray was the general manager at Channel 30 for a while, and you can still hear Bob Bray doing station breaks for WJMJ.
WJMJ Hartford at 88.9 FM, Hamden at 93.1, and New Haven at 107.1.
He's, of course, deceased now.
Phil Callan.
Here at JMJ, Peter Durham had been doing the morning show, and he died, and John Ellinger called me up and asked me to work.
Yeah, we get a lot of phone calls here. You know, people want to know where they can get a particular song. Or what happens is I bring out all these CDs and records and stuff, and I only play a small portion of them, and
right.
I spend a good part of the last hour putting them all away.
Bob Ellsworth.
It underscored an effort I was making to be on the air at WJMJ because talking to John Ellinger, I said, I'd like to do some work. He said, we'd like to have you do some work. What do you want to do? I said, well, I've got my own collection. And so I'm back on the air every Saturday from 4 to 5 o'clock in the afternoon with the Saturday Afternoon Pops.
So let's look at Operation Variety this afternoon, devoted to various soft and brassed sounds, big and small groups, and more from the baritones in our continual battle. Right now, the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, and this time it's Mr. Clark and his baton and Hooked on Can-Can.
In 2008, WJMJ provoked some controversy by dropping its ecumenical format to emphasize Catholic programming. Though various college stations had carried some individual NPR programs, Connecticut was one of the last states to put on a full-service National Public Radio affiliate. Connecticut Public Radio didn't come on the air until 1978. Paul Taff.
I came to what was Connecticut Educational Television Corporation in 1970, and basically it was television at that time. But at one of the board meetings, Senator Lou Rome, who was on our board, obviously, said, Paul, what are we doing about public radio? And I said, well, I've had enough to do with television, but our authority involves doing radio also. So we got a startup grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and then went through the whole process of getting it on the air.
Frank Donovan.
I was involved with the Connecticut Public Television Public Radio. I was on the Board of Trustees when we finally got what we now call WNPR.
There was no available frequency for this area.
We had to shoehorn that frequency, 90.5, in because by that time, down here in southern New England, just about every frequency was gone. And that frequency was controlled by a high school, I don't know, in Guilford or Madison, one of those places down there originally, okay? And then some friends of WFCR in Amherst got that.
There was a group called the Friends of WFCR down in New Haven, and they were using 90.5 as a translator.
And they built a small relay station on top of East Rock in New Haven to rebroadcast WFCR down there.
We talked to them about, wouldn't you give up the frequency, let us use it to get a larger population, a larger coverage area. A deal was made, and I was thinking it's through the other day, whether there's anything on paper, I'm not so sure, or it was a tacit agreement at least. friends of WFCR would give up that frequency, 90.5, if we would put a translator close enough to New Haven to continue to give them classical music. Okay. That's what they wanted, and that's what we agreed to.
And then one of those women got on our board of Connecticut Public Radio, Public Television, and then pushed Connecticut Public Television into radio at that time. That's how that all got started.
WTIC-FM's format change to drop classical music provided an opportunity for the new station. Again, Paul Taff.
TIC was beginning to talk about, maybe even made their change, and we were in the process of putting a station on the air, and they said they would give us some of their classical music's LPs.
Again, Frank Donovan.
When they finally got 90.5, they had to put the transmitter on Powder Ridge. One of our trustees came from Middlefield, and so to broadcast from where we were at Trinity College, to get a line of sight, we had to go to Powder Ridge. We could never shoot from Meriden Mount. Nowadays, it's up there.
We had to remodel some of the CPTV studios. Then we had to convert some of our studio space into radio space, and that's when I brought Bill Henry around. He was with TIC, and when they dropped out of, for the most part, any classical music, that was his main qualification, so
right.
we picked him up in a hurry.
Bill Henry
came here in 1978, and I'm actually the only original member of Connecticut Public Radio still here. I started working here in May of 1978, a couple of weeks before the station actually went on the air.
Here is music by the great George Frederick, Concerto Grosso No. 7 in B-flat major of Opus 6. The English concert is directed by Trevor Pinnock.
Connecticut Public Radio, WPBH, 90.5 FM, Middlefield, serving the greater Waterbury, Hartford, and New Haven areas.
WPBH, Public Broadcasting, Hartford.
It came on as WPBH. I had asked for WNPR, were our call letters at that time. WPLR down the road objected to it. And so behind the scenes did National Public Radio, because they frankly wanted a flagship station to come into Washington and run the whole network from there. Each of those objections were sustained by the commission, and they said no way for WNPR. Then I applied for WPBH, Public Broadcasting in Hartford.
You are listening to Connecticut Public Radio, WPBH 90.5 FM, Middlefield.
In 1984, the call letters were changed to WPKT to honor Paul K. Taff.
And eventually they decided to honor Paul Taff, Paul K. Taff, and so PKT was born.
WPKT, which is
right.
the former WPBH.
Right, and PKT, those are your initials, right?
That's right. It was Homer Babbage. He was the chairman of our board, and without my knowing it, he got through our engineer to make the contact at the commission and get it changed. In fact, I was looking just the other day at the change date, and that came on March the 19th, 1984, when it was changed to WPKT. It was later on when we were able to get one of the satellites called WNPR.
WNPR Norwich 89.1.
It was exciting, and one of the things, of course, that people were concerned about was when we do our first fundraiser, will people respond? And they did. They knew at that point that they had a winner. There was an audience for it, and the audience, at least in part, was willing to support the station.
Faith Middleton, she was a writer. She came to us and asked for a job, and she was hired. She did leave and went to the Hartford Current for a while, and that wasn't really what she wanted to do, and came back, and could she have her job back? And I said yes, and then later on we developed a studio in New Haven, and she started her specialty program, and she's great. One of the favorite things that was asked for when we started public radio, I can remember Tom Smith, who was vice president of Trinity and a member of our board, and he said, with this new radio station, Paul, are you going to have Robert J. Lertzema? And I looked at him, and I hadn't ever heard of Robert J. Lertzema. He was broadcasting out of GBH in Boston, but I hadn't been listening to GBH, so I didn't know anything about him.
Good morning. On this Sunday, it is the last day of October, October 31st. It is the first day of Standard Time, and it is also Halloween tonight. On Morning Pro Musica, in years past, we've had ghosts and goblins and witches and all kinds of spooky things to celebrate Halloween. Today, the second of a two-part series of programs, first of which was yesterday, dealing with tricks and treats. Along the way, today we'll find music that deals with various kinds of tricks, mostly tricks that are part of the plot of, for example, The Marriage of Figaro or The Merry Wives of Windsor, operas, the ballet, opera, operetta, ballet, and on occasion just a piece of music having to do with one kind of trick or another.
You know, if you look at the history of Connecticut Public Radio, when it first began and was heavy with classical music,
Steve Martin,
there was a morning announcer out of Boston named Lotsema.
Morning for Music is a program made possible by listener generosity with additional funding provided by a grant from Talbot's. Before we begin, a quick look at what's happening around the world. Some of today's news, edited and reported by your Morning Pro Musica host, Robert J. Lertzema. United Nations peace plan for Haiti is at stake today as 12 of Haiti's right-wing political groups threaten to install a government of their own.
Who was just a icon, and all the New England stations carried his morning show.
Well, later on, when I did get involved, by all means, we put on Robert J., and I got to know him quite well.
Very popular, and 7 to noon, as I recall, and carried the morning hours for years. Yeah. I can't forget Albert Goss, who actually started here the same time I did. While I did various things through the day, a Broadway Hollywood show and some classical music, Albert was a regular nighttime host, and Albert was, I believe he had a master's and also was a musician. It'd be difficult to find a more knowledgeable music personality on the air. He was every bit as knowledgeable as Robert J. Lertzema.
If jazz is your dish, you have your wish. For here's your mentor of music that moves, Mr. George Malcolm Smith.
Oh, thank you once again, Floyd Richards. And good evening, kind listeners. There's a jazz trumpeter we don't hear much or much about these days, and it's high time we did something about it. Those who have followed Count Basie through the years remember him well, and that distinguished jurist, Judge Simon Bernstein, insists that this particular horn blower is perhaps the greatest of them all. We're referring to a jazz man named Wilbur Clayton, better known as Buck, though I could never fathom why a gentle fellow of such exquisite taste was ever accorded such an inelegant label. Be that as it may, let's let the man speak for himself. Here he is, as he sounded about 10 years ago, offering an item entitled Kansas City Ballad. He's accompanied here by a compatible group, including the pianist Johnny Bunch.
I did work with George Malcolm Smith, and again, a unique personality, an author. He had one of his plays turned into a movie starring Donald O'Connor. I forget what the name of the movie was. But he worked at Travelers, I believe, on a full-time basis. But jazz was really his specialty, vintage jazz. He knew a lot about it, and he had a tremendous collection of vintage jazz recordings. Did the show here for a while, and a unique show it was. It was fun working with him.
The NPR's Morning Edition program really started to take off. So it began with Connecticut Public Radio adding at least a couple hours of Morning Edition, and then ATC in the afternoon.
For a long time, we had a dual format, classical music and talk and news. Now we are pretty much news talk.
You know, as is typical with radio, when you are one thing in the morning and then you switch to something else and then back to something else, it's hard to build and hold an audience. You also have a situation where the classical music audience is aging and it's not being replaced as it was in the past when people, before the baby boomers became 50, you started listening to classical music. Baby boomers are not turning to classical music in the way they did.
The thing that our management pointed out in making this change to the news format was that there are other stations that play classical music, but none in this area that have the NPR programming that we now have. And so that was the basic impetus for making the change.
So station saw that they had a format that was kind of dying, but it was also a need to just, you know, focus on one thing and do it well.
In 2011, the call letters for the Meriden affiliate swapped with the Norwich translator station to become WNPR. This program is dedicated to those who participated in interviews but who passed away before the program was finished. Bob Ellsworth, Fred Swanson, John Ellinger, Ivor Hugh, Paul K. Taff.
I am the morning DJ at WOLD. Playing all the hits for you, wherever you may be.
You've been listening to Connecticut Radio Memories, Episode 2. This program was produced and edited by Brandon Camp. Thanks to everyone who participated in interviews for this series, including those whose comments didn't make it to air. Interviews were edited for time, continuity, and clarity. This series would not have been possible without the air check collectors and other people and organizations who had the foresight to save air checks, jingles, or theme songs, and who shared them with us, including Ed Bruder from ManForMars.com, John Ramsey of HartfordRadioHistory.com, Larry Titus, Charlie Horowitz, Gary Lee Horn, Dwight Thurston, Robert J's WHUS Memories Museum, Russ Ginns, WGBH, Paul K. Taff, Mary Malcolm Smith, Reynolds Onderduck. We want to send a shout-out to Bill Hennessy and the bunch of old broadcasters who meet monthly to hear the Hartford Jazz Orchestra play at the Arch Street Tavern. Special thanks also to John Ramsey. Connecticut Radio Memories was produced at the studios of WWUH-FM at the University of Hartford. It's for you.